ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Back in 1987, Keith White was a builder and he was helping install ceiling sheets.
And I was up on scaffolding and he dropped his end and the sheet then fell down and pushed me sideways off the scaffolding and I fell 22 metres into a concrete shaft. So basically I broke quite a lot of my bones in my body and also tore ligaments and different things.
After being in hospital for almost a year, these injuries left Keith with chronic pain, being put on medication and offered spinal surgery.
Which I wasn't very keen on having because, you know, there was no guarantee it would actually fix it. So basically I persisted with having pain of some sort that continued for almost 30 years.
And that's a long time to be in pain and to continue working. And for many living with chronic pain, working is a non-negotiable because of finances and a sense of purpose.
Once they lose their purpose, which is their work, and often it means a heck of a lot, then they lose so much more emotionally, physically, and, you know, psychologically.
Hello, I'm Lisa Leong, and welcome to the second instalment of This Working Life series about your health at work. We're diving into chronic pain, how one in five of us experience it, but why there's still stigma around telling our bosses about it.
So in my first years, when I started feeling pain, I was quite silent about it.
You'll hear how transformational leadership can play a huge role in pain management at work and about a program that's helped Keith and many others to live and work.
I had a lot of different problems at the time. I had back pain, leg pain, I had sciatic pain, I had pain in my neck and shoulders. So you had to try to undo 30 plus years of what doctors had told me back then.
But first, let's get an understanding of what exactly chronic pain is and how it impacts us in our jobs.
To understand chronic pain, I think we should start with defining pain.
This is Dugu Biricek Gulsaran.
And I work as an assistant professor at the School of Human Resources Management at York University. So pain is a quite unpleasant sensation that many of us feel. We used to think that it was an outcome of tissue damage, but now we know that it is much more than a tissue damage. And chronic pain is called pain that lasts longer than 3 months.
You're based in Canada. How common is chronic pain there?
So Canadian statistics show that one in every five individuals at the working age have chronic pain.
And that seems similar then to Australian numbers because ours are one in five, aged 45 and over. So it seems like it's way more common than people might think.
It is. And although statistics change from, you know, source to source, we know that it is generally higher in working population because the overall age of working population is higher than the general population. So we tend to see more chronic pain cases in the workforce.
And it's increasing.
It is, and it is projected to increase even further by 2050.
Can we go to your personal story? So you've been living with chronic pain. How does it manifest for you?
My mom was my favorite person on earth and we were very close. And I lost her on my 16th birthday. And shortly after that, I started, and, you know, as you can imagine, this was a huge emotional trauma for me. I had a very long grief period. And shortly after that, I started feeling pain first on my lower back and then my neck and then all over my body. So I knew something was wrong, but it was hard to know what was wrong. But it actually never went away. So I to this day, I still live with chronic pain. But of course, I can manage it much better.
How were you managing it at work?
So at work, and because I study chronic pain, many of my colleagues and people I work with know that I am in pain when I am in pain, and they know that I have chronic pain in general. But of course, this is not as straightforward as it sounds. So in my first years, when I started feeling pain, I was quite silent about it. First, of course, I reached out to my family and friends, but it took me a while to disclose it in the workplace. And I vividly remember the time when I disclosed it to my supervisor. This was actually in my PhD. And I did it because I trusted that he would understand me and he would support me.
How did your supervisor respond and what happened then?
So my supervisor was an occupational health and safety expert. So he was a person who would know about this, he would teach about this. And he actually first acknowledged my pain, but he said, why don't you make this your research topic? So here I am years after my disclosure, I am studying pain, I'm still working on it, and I'm hoping that my research gets out there and helps people who need the most.
Let's look at how chronic pain actually impacts people's performance at work. So in your research and experience, what happens? How does it play out?
So this one of the most established findings in the literature on chronic pain is that chronic pain is a very individualistic experience. So not every two people experience pain in the same way, even though they have the same diagnosis and same underlying conditions. This is because modern pain researchers mostly agree on the biopsychosocial model of pain. That means not only biological factors, but also psychological and social factors play a huge role in how people experience pain. But in general, we know that people experience it differently. We know that pain is an invisible and episodic condition, so it can come and go, it can fluctuate within a day, and it can have different like episodic impact on how people perform their jobs. And in our research, we have some evidence that some people may have emotional difficulties as well because of their pain. They can be impatient with customers or colleagues, or they can feel exhausted quite easily, all because of their mismanaged pain.
In the early 2000s, Kathy Hubble was working in a major teaching hospital in Sydney and saw people with chronic pain weren't getting the help they needed.
For people to see a pain specialist, the initial consult waiting time was up to 3 years. And one of the things I had to do was do an audit on the waiting list. And I found people had died waiting, and there were so many people out there suffering. It was just incredible. And I just thought, you know what? There's got to be a way that we can give people some tools to use in the meantime while they're waiting to see a pain specialist.
What was your hypothesis as to what was missing here, Kathy?
Yeah, I think what was missing was education. We needed to find a way that we could instill knowledge in people and empower them to self-manage. And this just wasn't happening. And when they came into the health service, they were a passive entity. So they were still disempowered and they still didn't have knowledge about what they could do at home that would actually help them and prevent often what we see is pain getting worse and accidental overdoses.
As well as education, Kathy says validation is an essential part of treating chronic pain.
They wanted to hear that their pain was real. Because a lot of people think, you know, they go to their doctor, I've got this pain, and then they'll go and have scans and they'll have interventions, nothing works. And the doctor comes back and says, well, there's nothing on your scan, there's nothing wrong with you. And they start to think that they're going around the twist. You know, they think that this pain, maybe it isn't real. Maybe I'm making this up. And then they start to think, well, hang on a minute, it really pulls me up when I try to do something. So what we needed to do was actually validate these people that all pain is real. It is a brain-based construction. However, there are drivers within the nervous system and within the body that actually can precipitate a chronic pain scenario that doesn't show up on a scan. And this is the interesting thing, is we can make assumptions about what's on a scan, but that doesn't lead us to a cause of the pain.
And how would this impact their work lives, Kathy?
Really, really important. So a lot of the people that we work with are on a workers' compensation claim or an income protection claim. And we now know that it is far, far better to be back at work and feeling like they have a purpose, because once they lose their purpose, which is their work, and often it means a heck of a lot to them, then they lose so much more emotionally, physically, and psychologically. So we want to try and engage them back into the work environment or connect them with a new employer. And this is really fundamental to them reaching acceptance and then using the skills that they've learned in our program to then embed them in how they're actually going to move forward at work.
In that program Kathy just mentioned, she combines behaviour science and AI to help people reduce opioid use and manage their pain.
But we've taken it a step further in the digital platform, and that is that we've actually embedded all of the core competencies from the International Association for the Study of Pain into the education modules that we have within the program. We've also embedded Bloom's taxonomy of learning theory. So as people move through the learning modules, there we can actually see how the education is changing behaviour. And when you see the change in behaviour, then you can see the changes in the physical side of things, because we're now measuring with wearables oxygen saturations, heart rate variability, which is a measure of resilience. And we're also measuring their activity levels. But most importantly, we're actually able to see their sleep patterns and how sleep is interacting with mood, and mood is interacting with function, and so on and so forth. So behaviour is the essence of working their way out of this horrible scenario that they're in.
The way I got involved in Kathy's program was a bit of a fluke.
That's Keith Wyatt again. He stumbled upon Kathy's program after seeing her photo on social media.
When I saw the photo, I thought, I know that person. So I then contacted her and said, hi, you know, I noticed you do chronic pain management and, you know, we went to school together. And of course, she remembered who I was. And then I went and had a consultation with her. You know, she had to try to undo 30 plus years of what doctors had told me back then, and also what other doctors had told me over years and years and years. See, like, I had a lot of different problems at the time. I had back pain, leg pain, I had sciatic pain, I had pain in my neck and shoulders. And when she went for each different issue, she said that, you know, most of the things were working perfectly. There was no, you know, injury as such that was stopping me from doing things. And she said, it seems that your nervous system has got an inflammation type of thing that causes the pain sensors to react. And she said also, because I'd had pain for a number of years, my brain had kind of got used to that function, and it was keeping me in that mode of sensing pain when I shouldn't be sensing pain. And after I did do the program, it actually got rid of the whole lot. It was gone for good. So I was like amazed. And it was interesting that where the day before I had pain at a certain point in doing exercise, the next day when I did what they suggested to try, I didn't have pain. It went away. And that was when in my head the penny dropped and I thought, wait a minute, my pain is controlled by my brain. And if I can tell my brain that I haven't got that pain, it's not there.
I'm Lisa Leong. You're listening to This Working Life on ABCRN. For our second instalment in our series about your health at work, we're digging into chronic pain at work, how many of us are living and working with it, and why we're not telling our bosses about it. In your experience, how common is it for people to try to hide their chronic pain at work?
I think there's more out there than we really know.
Kathy Hubble again.
And we know that people are working on a daily basis with pain. So it's all about a really nice working together dynamic to keep people in the workforce so that they're not retiring early and creating financial distress. Now they can go to their boss and say, look, you know, I'd really be grateful if I could work from home 3 days a week. So I can then use my pacing skills in my home environment better than being in the office. And this is working out to be extremely helpful for people.
One thing that's holding people back from talking about it at work is stigma. And that has to be chipped away at to help people keep working and feel satisfied in their jobs.
So if this negative view is coming from others, we call it external stigma. But if you judge yourself for having a particular quality, then this becomes an internal stigma.
Dugu Biracek-Gulsaran again from York University. And Dugu, what are the implications of this stigma?
Research shows that stigma, whether it's internal or external, can lead to silence, and silence can be a barrier in getting help that we need. And this help can be a medical help or work-related help. So it doesn't have to be fixing the problem, but also help with managing work and working in pain. But I think with internal stigma, the problem is that we may self-select out. So for instance, let's say there's a promotion opportunity, and because we don't think we deserve it, we may choose not to pursue it. But of course, there's implications for organizations as well. So organizations can pay a significant cost too. Managers may never know what is going on with their employees. If you don't know what exists, how can you manage them, right? So ultimately, there's a chance that you would lose your human capital. And in the case of chronic pain, is 20% of your workforce.
You and your fellow researchers describe chronic pain at work as a leadership issue. Why is that?
So leaders are in a unique position in organizations. So first of all, organizations pay a cost for mismanaged pain. There's this financial cost, there's absenteeism, presenteeism. By presenteeism, I mean showing up work as sick. There is disability claim. So there's a financial cost for organizations. But there's also, you know, intangible costs as well, like reduced morale, you know, reduced job satisfaction, productivity. So we know that organizations are a stakeholder in chronic pain in the workplace. And leaders are in a unique position because they interact with employees on a daily basis. They influence employees both directly and indirectly. And they are the only group within an organization who can have so much agency in helping or hindering chronic pain with chronic pain issues in the workplace. So that's why leadership is important, and that's why we think it's a leadership problem.
You say that helpful leadership is transformational leadership. What's that?
It is defined in four interrelated behaviors or behavior groups. So the first one is individualized consideration. So that means getting to know employees individually, checking in with them, knowing their needs and knowing their styles. So it's you know, having a personal and somewhat, you know, a close relationship with them or getting to know them on an individual basis. The second group of transformational leadership behaviors is intellectual stimulation. So that means encouraging creative problem solving or innovative solutions. So let's say your employee has chronic pain, they want to work, and you may, you know, help them find ways that work for them in their own conditions. So you can encourage them to think of out of the box and come up with solutions that would work for them. And they don't have to be, you know, traditional solutions. They can be, you know, unique and idiosyncratic ways.
The third behavior in transformational leadership is inspirational motivation.
So in the case of chronic pain, this can be, you know, showing or communicating your employee that the future is positive And the last group of behaviors is idealized influence, which can be defined as having values and acting accordingly. So in the case of chronic pain, this can be being a role model. A leader with chronic pain can, for instance, share their stories, you know, become a role model, or in general, acting in accordance with values.
Kathy, take me through the results of your program. How did it impact people's capacity to return to work?
Yeah, we had some outstanding results, huge reductions in depression, anxiety, fatigue, sleep disturbance, with on average around 50% reduction in those scores. But most importantly, we had around a 50% reduction on average in pain score. So that's the difference between functioning and not functioning. So if you think about it, if you had a pain score of 8 out of 10, which is quite severe, and you were able to halve that, you could function. You could get stuff done. You can get back to work. You can really enjoy life. And that's really, really important. The reasoning behind that we say could allow a return to work was because most of the people we worked with were actually employer detached. So they'd been on claim for more than 3 years and up to 10 years. And some of the people ceased their opioids altogether and went back to work full time.
It's really huge. What have you noticed then about the rollout of the program and how it's changed the conversation around chronic pain at work?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I just presented last week at a workers' compensation conference in Melbourne. And I was really, really surprised and delighted to see the conversations around personalised care, around, you know, human interventions, but using digital health and AI. So there was a lot of interest in what we were doing, and they just loved the fact that we could do personalised care for a person to return to work.
One thing Keith White recommends to keep in mind when you do return to work is watch your stress levels.
Your employers and people you work with, they are really in the dark. They don't understand it at all. And what I have found in my own personal experience is the stress over time makes it flare up if you don't know how to manage it. And I had never realised that for the 30 years I had pain, when I had really bad times with it, I always had very stressful times. So I find that people don't really understand how the stress that can be put on you or other factors that will, you know, like anxieties or things like that, that causes pain.
And finally, here are Dugu's tips to handle chronic pain at work.
From an individualistic perspective, I think it's so important to understand that this is common. You're not the only one. Many people who are in the workforce is experiencing chronic pain. And secondly, because I'm a psychologist, of course, this will be my perspective or my lens, but understand that pain has psychological and social components as well. Research very consistently shows that pain and mental health problems feed each other. And also, I would say seek social support. So even if this is not available in your department, seek out it in the larger organization. Maybe there's someone who can help you. For organizations, I think psychosocial aspect of managing pain is more important, or at least less known. But I would say give more autonomy and control on how and when and where people do their work. Provide flexibility and flexible benefits. So not the same solution can work for everyone. So if people have the option to choose based on their needs, that'd be ideal. And also, I would say, believe your employees when they disclose pain, because pain is a very personal experience.
Thanks to my guests, Dr. Dugu Berecek-Gulsaran, Assistant Professor at York University, Kathy Hubble, founder of Amelio Health, and thanks to Keith Wyatt for sharing his story. I'm Lisa Leong. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It's produced by Zoe Ferguson and mixed by Tim Jenkins. In our next installment in our health series, suck it up, princess. What happens when we can't express our emotions at work? And what happens if we overshare? Don't miss it. Make sure you follow the podcast to get our new episodes when they drop. This episode was produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Until next time, work it, baby.